E4E is brought to you by the University of Delaware Partnership for Public Education. In an effort to increase the availability and accessibility of UD expertise to Delaware's P12 educators, leaders, and policy influencers, we have invited faculty members from the University of Delaware's 9 colleges to share their research. We hope you enjoy today's critical conversation and consider ways you might be able to leverage relevant research and UD expertise to advance policy and transform practice.
Hi, I'm Kristen Chisholm, a former public school teacher and current PhD student with a relentless curiosity for all things education. And I'll be your host for today's episode. Today, we're exploring one of the most exciting yet challenging phases in an educator's journey, transitioning from student teacher to lead teacher. We're joined by Dr. Elizabeth Soslow, a professor at UD's College of Education, who will share research-driven strategies for supporting first-year teachers.
Hi, Elizabeth. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Before we dive into today's topic, could you tell us a bit about your journey? What inspired you to pursue a career in education and eventually become a researcher?
So I started off teaching in the public school system in Philadelphia. I taught 5th through 8th grade literacy enrichment courses. Our school partnered with LaSalle University, and I was part of a cohort of teachers that went through this partnership project. And I designed a research study in tandem with my college professor mentor. And at the end of the year, my mentor suggested that I pursue a PhD. And I thought she was crazy, but I decided to go for it. And I ended up at the University of Delaware and earned my PhD. And I was fortunate enough to be hired by the University of Delaware. My first few years as an assistant professor, I served predominantly as a field instructor, which means I had a cohort of students that I followed into the field, observed their teaching, and then gave feedback to them. I became interested in what meaning my students were making of my feedback and of our post-observation conferences after they taught. And so that really was kind of my first 10 years of my research agenda, was in studying that interaction.
What strengths have you noticed that new teachers bring to the classroom?
The new teachers that the University of Delaware's teacher prep programs produce, there's a high level of enthusiasm. The majority of our students have been successful students themselves, and they're looking to recreate those opportunities for their own future students. So they enter the field incredibly excited and engaged. More recently, I would say in the last 5 years, our teacher candidates start their teaching career well-equipped with lots of coursework and projects around culturally responsive pedagogy, understanding the beauty in diverse classrooms, in students who come from diverse neighborhoods. So they come with a lot of very good intentions and good ideas about what they want to do in their classrooms for their students and for their students' communities.
They're coming in with a lot of enthusiasm, really excited to get to work with kids. What challenges do they encounter?
Sure. So I actually have a chapter in my book that includes 7 common pitfalls that our teacher candidates encounter, and then obviously in their first year or two of teaching, these pitfalls are still apparent. So I won't go through all 7 of them, but I think I'll talk about the ones that are most salient. And that is, our candidates often, and first-year teachers, novice teachers, often make assumptions about the students and the communities that they're working in. While they're incredibly excited to work with these students and create learning contexts where students can thrive and be their whole selves, they make judgments, assumptions, attributions about the students and their families without getting to know the students and the families. So we encourage our candidates, as well as first-year teachers, to really get out and be in the community, go to the places of worship where your students go to the supermarket, explore what the community resources are in terms of parks and libraries and resource centers. Drive your car around the neighborhood where your students live. Take public transportation around the neighborhood. Really understand, or at least begin to understand, the lived experiences of your students without making assumptions about who they are or where they come from. Another pitfall that novice teachers face is not feeling a sense of belonging in their classroom community or in their school. So a lot of novice teachers, first-year teachers, report feeling a lack of confidence or feeling unsure, almost like if you went to a large social event, a large party, and you didn't know anybody and you walked in, that kind of social anxiety actually carries through for teachers. They're walking into a school building where they don't know anyone, and they're walking into a classroom full of students who they don't know. And unlike a party where you can have a libation to relax and kind of ease your way in, that would be incredibly frowned upon in the school setting. First year teachers have to figure out how to navigate their own anxiety, their own desire to feel a sense of belonging, with balancing their need to educate and make students feel a sense of belonging. So that's kind of a murky territory that first year teachers tend to find challenging. I would also say that there's this sense that they want to recreate the experiences that they've had, or that they imagine their teachers were embodying when they were students themselves. So this traditional kind of framework that you must be in control, that the kids have to listen to you, that it should be quiet, it should be orderly. Getting first-year teachers to understand that classrooms can be spaces of joy, that necessitate messiness, that necessitate noise, that necessitate unknown reactions to lessons and things like that is really, really hard for new teachers to kind of wrap their head around. Based on my research, and this is a decade worth of research projects and publications, I kind of bucket teacher learning into three main areas or themes. And I write about this quite a bit in my first book, The Comprehensive Guide to Working with Student Teachers. So growth confidence is the ability to learn from your own teaching, to position yourself continuously as a teacher of learning, but also a learner of teaching. And navigating that space in a way where you can use your own teaching experiences, your successes and your failures, as the curricula that you learn from moving forward. So reflecting on your practice in ways that are going to improve your practice over time. So oftentimes you'll hear people say, oh, well, with more experience, you'll get it. Or, you know, you just need a couple more years in the field and then you'll know what you're doing. And common sense tells us that that's completely wrong. If that were true, every veteran teacher would be the most amazing teacher you've ever met. So it's not time and experience that makes you a better teacher. It's systematic reflection on those experiences and incremental change over time. So that's the first kind of bucket, this idea of growth competence. The second part is collaborative expertise. So collaborative expertise is this ability to work in tandem with your colleagues on problems of practice, on curricular development, on innovative teaching approaches, on exploring new pedagogical frameworks, things like that. So do you know how to insert yourself in a professional learning community in a way that is beneficial to everyone, to yourself and to your colleagues? So this is the ability to step up and step back in conversation, the ability to take on feedback and criticism, the ability to push back and against teachers or other folks in the school community who may be engaged in doing things that are actually harmful for children. So do you know how to speak up? In my second book, which is aptly called When You're the New Teacher, I actually give discussion protocols for new teachers to engage with their colleagues in productive ways. But again, to reemphasize, collaborative expertise, without it, you're a lone wolf. You have no one to support you, and you are not contributing in ways to benefit the learning community of which you're a part of in any school. That's the second bucket. The third bucket is adaptive teaching expertise. And this is how teachers notice the novelness of teaching dilemmas that seem to be routine. So, you know, I'll take you, Kristen, you're in my classroom, you never raise your hand. Well, that's routine, right? There's a student who doesn't raise their hand, doesn't elect to participate often. So I perceive that as, oh, you're confused, you don't understand, you're shy, you're bored, or you don't care, right? That would be a routine response to routine behavior. But what's novel about it? So if I'm a teacher practicing adaptive teaching expertise, I'm going to start to drill down and say, well, I notice Kristen's work is really high caliber. She demonstrates really good understanding of content. When we do small group work, she's leading her small group. She is a constant contributor. I wonder what's going on here. And so as a teacher practicing adaptive teaching expertise, I don't fall prey to, here are the typical reasons she's not responding. Let me pull a popsicle stick out and call her name, you know, to respond. Now, instead, I'm going to drill down. I'm going to meet with you individually, and I'm going to say, Kristen, I noticed that your, you know, individual work is fabulous. You understand, you can grasp the content. I notice when you're in a small group, you contribute really well and you become a leader in that group. I'm wondering, what's stopping you from raising your hand during larger group discussions? And from there, I might find out all kinds of things. You know, you're nervous speaking in front of large groups, or you're never quite sure if what you're going to say is going to be criticized by someone else, or you know you have the right answer, but you're worried if now's the time. Like, so there could be lots and lots of reasons.
Lots of reasons.
And once I understand that reason, I can then support you in hopefully participating during large group. Maybe you need to write your answer first on a post-it note. I cruise by, I take a look at it, I give you a thumbs up, and that gives you enough courage to say, okay, I'm going to share this idea out loud. Maybe I need to back build it where you share it with a partner and then your partner shares your idea out loud. And that's the whole class access to your thinking. It doesn't have to be you raising your hand. So this idea that you see the novelty in what seems to be routine is part of adaptive teaching expertise. Another component of adaptive teaching expertise is balancing your innovative teaching practices with risk to pupil well-being and their learning, right? So teachers are responsible both for the academic learning of their students, but also their emotional well-being in the classroom. So if you want to try a new methodological approach, or you want to bring in a new reading that you've never used before in your sixth grade classroom, what measures are you taking to think about the balance between this new approach or new content that you want to bring into the classroom with students' well-being and their academic progress? So figuring out how to balance that is important. Is the risk worth the reward, right?
Yeah.
The third one is noticing pupil cues and making a change in real time. So in the moment adaptations to your practice. So maybe you notice that the kids are not engaging. Are they bored? Are they confused? Are they disinterested? So figuring out the why and then figuring out the what next, right? Mm-hmm. So now teachers have a really hard time with this. A, number one, noticing. Noticing is this whole huge framework in the literature. I don't know if you've ever heard of the gorilla experiment, but there's this very famous experiment where there's a bunch of kids bouncing a ball to each other, a group of six. And in the background, a gorilla walks through, and there's all kinds of
variations. I have seen that one. Okay. Yeah.
There's all kinds of variations. So sometimes their shirt color changes, sometimes the background color changes. And what we know from novice teachers is they don't always notice these things. And it's the same thing when they're teaching. I've observed many, many, many teacher candidates and first-year teachers teach a lesson, and nobody's listening, nobody's paying attention, nobody's writing anything down, no one's engaged. But at the end of the lesson, you meet with them and you say, how'd it go? And they say, great. And you say, what makes you say great? And they say, I finished the lesson on time. And we call that brick wall teaching. You're teaching the brick wall, right? You're going to teach what you're going to teach, how you're going to teach, no matter what happens in front of you. So a teacher that's practicing adaptive teaching expertise is going to notice, right? They're going to notice which kids are checked out, which kids are confused, why they're confused. And then they're going to pull into their proverbial bag of tricks for an alternative approach, right? Do I need to pull a small group right now? Do I need to break down a concept? Do I need to throw something on the smart board and show it with pictures? Do I need to stop and check in, right? There's all kinds of moves that teachers can make in the classroom, but knowing a move needs to happen and then which move to make and then what to look for to see if that move was successful is incredibly complex. And it happens in an instant. So that's the third component of adaptive teaching expertise, balancing the innovation and experimental teaching approaches against risk to pupil learning and well-being, continuously questioning what seems to be routine by acknowledging the novelty of problems, and then noticing pupil cues, evaluating decision-making, and selecting and applying alternative decisions in the moment during teaching practice.
So what does that look like as you're growing as a teacher and you're learning these skills? What would that look like?
So growth looks like, if you think about these three buckets, growth would look like teachers who are engaged in learning communities, who are actively engaged, who are pushing their own thinking, the thinking of others, who are out in the community and meeting with parents and community elders to learn about what's best for the students in front of them. Teachers who are engaged in systematic reflection on their practice, teachers engaged in action research, teachers who go to conferences to share what they've learned about their practice, teachers who keep journals, teachers who engage in advanced credentialing. It looks like teachers in classrooms where kids are also teachers, where students can be their whole selves, where students are thriving both emotionally and academically, students who treat each other really well, students who want to be there. The teacher is excited and enthusiastic about innovating their practice year after year after year. Teachers who rewrite their curriculum and lesson plans, redesign their syllabi, pick new teaching materials. Teachers who take the time to get to know their students. So I think that's what it would look like.
And how can we, as a community of educators, support that growth?
So there's a couple of things, and I write about this actually in both of my books in very different ways. So one is to go back to what I was talking about before about growth confidence, this dual role, this embodiment of dual roles. I am a teacher of learners, but I'm also a learner of teaching, and to normalize that. I think that parents, grandparents, school community members view teachers as the expert and the person who has the answers. And I think that that's problematic. I think absolutely you could be a content area expert, but your kids change every single semester or every single year. So it would be incredibly difficult to say that you're a classroom culture expert with those particular kids in your classroom, right? So to normalize this idea that teachers are always learning about teaching, I think would be incredibly important to the field. Normalize teachers asking for help, teachers working together on inquiry projects, freeing up time, paid compensated time for teachers to work together to improve their practice, I think would be really, really important. So there's the normalization of continuous learning, and then there's the resources for continuous learning. So I would say that's the first kind of necessary condition for teacher growth. I think the second is this idea of agency building and power and positioning. So how are we positioning teachers to be agents of change in their schools and in the communities that they're serving? And how are they partnering teachers with community members to make that change? I think that, you know, there's a view of teachers, I teach math, reading, science, social studies, and then I go home and I do whatever I do, right? But I think that if teachers are repositioned as community partners, community activists, community agents of change, I think we would have true community schools where there is a collaborative writing of curriculum, where there is many, many more community members in the school serving as educators, really positioning, I think, teachers in a power dynamic where they have a say over what they do in their classrooms, and that that power is distributed between them and the community that they're serving, and away from, you know, a central administration. So I'm thinking, for example, of the Philadelphia School District where I taught. We were given curriculum and scripted guides. And if we weren't on the right page of the right day of the week when we were being observed, we were written up. When I was a school-based teacher leader, my principal charged me with writing scripts for teachers. I think that's really the wrong way to go. So I think this idea of positioning power and agency building is really critical for teacher growth, continued growth. The last kind of condition I think that needs to be satisfied is this focus on pupil learning. So we're really interested in high test scores, things that can be measured. And I actually don't have a problem with any of that. I just think it's one piece of what we want for our students and children. So there's a lot of resources in schools that are not going towards pupil learning, right? There's a lot of policies that are not focused on pupil learning. And I think that when we recenter pupil learning, everyone in the school becomes a teacher. So there's community schools you'll hear about where the janitor is perceived as a teacher, where the cafeteria workers are perceived as teachers, where everything everyone does every second of every day is focused on supporting the children in the building. And I think that a reorientation of policy efforts on student learning, real learning, critical learning, is another necessary condition. So I would say those are the three kind of conditions: that embodiment of dual roles, teacher as learner and learner of teaching, and that positioning power and agency building, and then that refocusing and doubling down on pupil learning.
What projects are you currently working on?
I'm writing my third book right now. I work with a nonprofit organization in Philadelphia that teaches teachers how to implement critical social justice framework called service learning. And it's a critical consciousness raising pedagogy that helps students identify root causes, social issues that impact their community, and situate that in a broader social change orientation. I find it absolutely exciting, innovative, joyful. For me, that's what teaching is, what this organization does. I was a teacher for Need Indeed when I was in Philadelphia. I then joined their advisory board as a teacher. And then when I graduated with the PhD, they put me on the board. And I'm now the chair of the board for the organization. I am currently working on a series of interviews with former Need Indeed teachers to write a book about how the framework helps teachers innovate their teaching, their classroom culture, their curriculum, and transform their relationships with their students and the school community and the community the school serves. So that's the book I'm writing now. It's in the early stages. I'm interviews start next week. It feels a little daunting, as it always does when you're staring at a blank piece of paper, but I'm really excited about it.
Thank you so much for being on our podcast today.
You're welcome. I hope it was useful.
As always, thank you for tuning in to E4E, Evidence for Education. If you found today's episode helpful, please consider sharing it with a colleague or leaving us a review. Also, don't forget to follow us on X at UDelPPE and visit our website at ppe.cehd.udel.edu. If you have ideas for future podcast topics, please email us at ppe-info@udel.edu.